Michael Hanna of St. Vito Focacciaria might just be a genius. Thank you for tuning into the What's Good Dough podcast, brought to you by Uni Pizza Ovens, Cordo Olive Oil, and Baccio Cheese. What I can say about Michael Hanna, aside from the fact that he is so freaking smart, is that he reminds me of a down-to-earth Chef Bradley Cooper from the movie Burnt. They kind of look alike. They have just this drive to create something delicious, but Michael Hanna does not have that excessive baggage. At least it doesn't appear like it. Seems like a regular guy to me. Now, why do I say all of this? Well, his pizza is just something that I have not heard of before. So unique. I'm talking 90% naturally leavened pan pizza. Thick boys. Right, Jimmy Hank? Thick boys, not just on Thursday, but all day, every day. We do a deep dive in Michael's process and how he uses sourdough, why he stopped using commercial yeast, his bake times, all of that. We go deep, and it is so, so, so valuable. Not only do we talk about pizza, but we talk about business and life. We incorporate Michael's story in this. We learn about his lessons learned starting off from his home and how he's building his community. Trust me, this is an amazing conversation. So sit down, relax, and enjoy the show. And remember to always ask, what's good dough? Welcome back to the show, everybody. I have Michael Hanna of St. Vito Focacciaria, Nashville, Tennessee. I'm really excited to talk to this individual right here because I'm literally drooling over the pizza. And I have so many questions because I like sourdough. I love it, actually. And it's such a hard thing to rock with. And so we're going to spend a lot of time on the dough today, get Michael's backstory and all of that good stuff. Michael, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm great, man. Thanks for having me.
We're going to try to work through Michael's process. And interestingly enough, he didn't want to cook other people's food, but I am just so interested and I want to try cooking your food because, again, looks beautiful. And maybe we can start, even before we start making dough, you're working with sourdough. And talk to us about like the flours you use there, the hydration. Are you making a poolish with that or a leaven? However you want to describe it, maybe start there.
We used to not do a levain, but moving into this brick and mortar space, we're looking for streamlined process and consistency, right? As a pop-up, kind of just making dough as we go and moving around and whatnot.
That consistency really matters when you're on a schedule commercially.
We do 20% starter always for our levain. And then that will consist of 20% of our dough. We use a very high protein flour for our levain and our starter. We made the switch to King Arthur high gluten flour. It's a good flour. It's consistent and it's cost effective for us.
Is that for the levain or for?
No, that's for the dough itself, right? The levain, we use Central Milling High Mountain flour.
Okay.
And I've used some Red Rose of theirs too. The problem I found with that one is that it is a bit malt. It's got some malt in it, and you got to keep an eye on your fermentation process a little bit. So,
but spike the yeast a bit.
Yeah. So because it's got the malt, it's got the diastatic, and it will kind of speed up that process a little bit. We get it. We make that at night before we leave, and then when we get in the morning, we're immediately taking a look at what the temperature is in the building. For me, when we were building the space out, we're really small. We have all heated and air conditioned return air for our kitchen to keep it consistent. If we didn't have that, like in the summer, it would be 95 degrees in here. In the winter, it's all heated in air conditioned to try and keep a consistent temperature best we can for dough making. And as soon as we get in, we come check that temperature. We'll kind of do some baker's percentages with temperature of the air and water and whatnot. And we start mixing. I've got a big old S-Mach mixer. Do like a really easy, slow first mix. Once it's done after that, we'll add our levain. We'll go kind of another slow little mix. and then we'll rip it, kind of get it going.
Is the S-Mock mixer a spiral?
It is. Yeah.
Okay. Spiral. So what you're doing is sort of, because it's such a wet dough, you're letting that autolyse really start the gluten development so that you're not heating it up.
Yep. And just hydrating it just as much as possible. Right. It'll come together on the high speed. You know, I think there's a lot of variables there. And I think with making it over and over and over and over and over again, you just kind of like figure out like kind of what it's going to do. You know, every bag of flour is different, regardless of what they say, you know, it is.
100%.
It's all different. And if you're not able to pick those small minor details out in the very, you know, initial mixes of your dough that day, you know, you're just a learning process. You're going to have to figure that part out, right? So water, oil, sugar, all goes into the mixer. And then we're on 50-pound increments, so like whole 50-pound bag straight up in there. One little nice mix. It's like 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes just to get it shaggy, kind of mixed together. 1 hour autolyse. We come back to it, add our levain, another quick like 2 minute mix, and then we rip it on speed two so it starts to come together. Once it starts to come together, we'll fold in our salt. We fold in our salt, and then it goes directly into tubs, our proofing boxes.
The sugar and the oil, is that with the rip, or is that when you're folding the salt in?
So I think maybe this is something that we do. It's like, well, whoever said you couldn't, you know? It's like
many ways to skin the cat.
Right, yeah. So when we put all of our water, sugar, and oil into our container, and we hit it with a immersion blender, a big one, and we mix it all up.
Ooh.
It's all mixed up. And it kind of emulsifies, honestly. Oil emulsifies into the water with sugar, because the water's never hot, right? So it's always kind of cool. And it goes directly into, and we only use sugar in the raw. We don't use white sugar. It's only sugar in the raw. And that's just because, number one, I like the flavor more. It's less like refined, you know, because it's not. I find that white sugar sometimes is like too sweet, and it leaves this like weird thing on the side of your tongue when you eat something that it's in there. And sugar is added to this dough because traditionally this Spanish ciabatta is made with sugar, and it helps color, and it also helps with fermentation. We add all that into the mixer, we pour our flour in, we mix it, we autolyse, we add our levain, we mix it, we add our salt at the very, very end, and then it goes into tubs. Now, that's where the tricky part is once it gets into our tubs, you know, there's no
time. You're looking at it and you know, okay.
It has to be a touch and a feel.
Sugar and olive oil emulsified. What? That sounds delicious. And you know what would make that even more delicious is if you used Cordo olive oil. You know the deal. Cordo makes the most amazing olive oil that will add fresh flavors to anything that it touches, even your dough. I swear, when I make pizza dough with Cordo, I can absolutely smell the difference. If you want to learn more and schedule a tasting, you can do so for free if you're an operator. I'm talking home pizza make, I'm talking pop-up operator, caterer, or even brick and mortar. Just let me know and I will connect you with Cordo. Use the link in the show notes. And if you want to buy any Cordo olive oil via their website, also use the link in the show notes. I appreciate you for supporting the show. Okay, before we try to describe that as best as we can and as simply as possible in this podcast, it almost seems like an impossible feat. We'll try.
Yeah.
Oil percentages and sugar percentages. And do you, when you say 100% hydrated dough, is that 100% water or is that 100% including the oil?
Well, so it's the levain is 100%. And then the water that goes in is going to be at 90.
90. Okay.
So when I make the dough versus, you know, if I train somebody to make the dough, I can just kind of tell like the flour batch that we have. It's like, hey, yesterday it was a little loose. It didn't really come together right. Let's drop that 90 to 80 and then keep that 100%. We never do anything other than 100% levain. it kind of can give or take, but rarely. When I'm first training someone on the dough, I will have them make it a little less, and then as we move week by week, we'll gradually increase that water back up, so that it helps them see what it looks like at a little bit lower percentage, and then see what it looks like at the really high percentage. At one point in time, we were using all mountain flour, right? The central milling. That flour can handle as much water as you want to give it. So like 110% hydrated, that sucker's just soaking it up and going. I have been like really nerded out. I'm not a trained baker. I never worked in a bakery. Sometime in the middle of my career, my dad and I started an organic vegetable farm outside of Memphis, Tennessee, in Arkansas, on our family land. I was working for Andy Tyser and Michael Hudman. They've been on all the Beard lists and all that good stuff for years. And I was working at their fine dining restaurant. And then on my days off, I was driving back to my dad's house in Arkansas, and we were working on a farm. I was growing little vegetables and whatnot just for the restaurant. And we were bringing them in, whatnot. Well, that kind of grew into like a real interest on learning, a business side of things, fresh food, you know, the difference in flavor of carrot picked from the ground, carrot bought from, you know, whatever distributor you have that's been flown halfway across the country or driven. But we started growing wheat. And I got really into learning about wheat and milling. And I never baked then. This was like 14 years ago. I never knew, like, I just think that, like, I think it's kind of fate, you know, like that knowledge that I gathered while growing wheat, different types of emmers and einkorns and whatnot, kind of helped me later in life whenever I started baking this bread and I understood all these different flours.
And the nuances around water and absorption and all of that.
Yeah.
Because you knew that all of these wheats were so different from each other.
Yeah, when we started doing this too, or when we were opening the brick and mortar, I was like, we were putting a little spelt in the dough, and we were putting a little this in there, and we were really experimenting with it because it was like, okay, finally I have my own space. 3 years as a pop-up. I'm really going to make the most of it, right? But quickly, I think you learn that the most important aspect of running a business is consistency, that you're offering the same exact product every single time somebody walks in. And when you deal with all these specialty flours, you're never going to get a consistency. Because like we said, even though every King Arthur bag is a little bit different, you're talking about big differences when you're talking about fresh milk spelts and rye and emmers. Like those things, they're so active, sometimes you don't even get a chance for fermentation. They just go, you know, like it just overproofs immediately, you know, like and it, especially like in hot summer in the South, you know, like it's, you know, 90% humidity half the time all summer. It's like, it's tricky. So
super interesting.
So from the mixer into the boxes, it's a feel thing. It's stretch every 30 minutes, stretch and fold.
So you're not mixing to full gluten development?
No. I am to an extent. Once it starts to lift off the sides of the bowl and form what we kind of describe as butt cheeks, you know, going around the arm. We're like, yeah, once you see little butt cheeks, shut it off, you know. Let it rest for a second before you take it out of the bowl. And then...
And why do the stretch and folds versus just like fully getting it to like this like super white color and all of that? Is it possible?
Yeah, it's possible. It's a long mix. It heats it up is what I found. And it makes the temperature rise, which is going to kind of cook your dough a little bit.
What if you just use like ice water?
Could. Like we said, from a consistency level, it's easier for us to say when it starts to look like this, you take it out. When it hits the boxes, you stretch and fold every 30 minutes. That is a touch. That's me teaching other people. This is what it feels like. This is what it feels like on your first stretch. This is what it feels like on your fourth stretch. This is what it feels like on your fifth stretch, right? And it only takes like making it 2 or 3 days in a row for it to click and just be like, all right, this is my fourth stretch. And it is going. It looks totally different than what it looked like when it went into the box. It's super glossy and shiny. It's real creamy. It, you know, it pulls real nice whenever we pull it up. Like, that's them learning, you know. Then I don't have to be next to them all the time being like, all right, do this, do that, right? So, like, they get the feel of it.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point, because you develop that relationship with that dough versus just like, all right, hit it in the mixer, and the next thing you know, like, you overmix, you undermix, and you put it in the fridge, and the dough sucks.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know, I mean, it's kind of corny, I guess, but like, you got to have that relationship with the product, especially a product that's so hands-on. You know, and for however long we've been on this planet, we've been making, most of the time, aside from the past 100 years, we've been making bread by hand, right? So like, the feel of it is natural to humans, I guess, you know? And then you invent the mixer and mass production and commercial yeast and all these things and whatnot. And it kind of changes everything. But like how are you supposed to know what it is if you're letting the machine do all the work, especially when it comes to something as volatile as a fermentation? You can feel the dough, like, when it's ready to go into the walk-in to retard, like, you can feel it in your fingers. I always ask people to, like, pinch the dough, and if it feels like when you're pinching a sponge, like a wet sponge, little bubbles all in there kind of popping in between your fingers, like, it's ready. Like, it's forming, it's going. You know, in each stretch and each fold, like, you're just building more strength and building more layers and more little secrets, so all the gas can get stuck in there to form you a beautiful crumb. And that's what we really go for, and that's kind of the process that because we don't bake like other pizzerias, right? We par-bake everything. We bake no sauce, no anything, because the important thing for us is that we have that integrity of our crumb. Like, you see that crumb, and then we're able to pick those up to order, and then we top everything off that, you know, after that. I don't know too many people that do it that way either. I mean, I think there are some, but it's just a little different.
Commercial yeast, while we're on the topic, because when I was listening to your episode on Pizza City, which was fantastic, you blew Steve's mind. If anyone is, you know, looking for more history or just more content with Michael, it was a great episode. So check that out. But you were using commercial yeast back then because of the inconsistencies of your pop-up. I'm assuming you're no longer using it now. What has been the biggest difference for you?
I know you're kind of asking like the biggest difference between using the commercial yeast and versus not using the commercial yeast. Using commercial yeast just guaranteed me that if I had a variable that it couldn't control as a traveling pop-up, that I could still get a product out with the brick and mortar, with our space. I don't want that crunch. If there's a way to figure it out, we can figure it out. We had a guy that was, he's very serious about his bread making. They make great bread, great pizza over at Folk. He started a bread program at Rolf when they first opened, and then he hired a guy named Michael Madsen that is an incredible baker. And part of our jobs as line cooks was to, you know, keep up with the starter for him when he wasn't there, maybe do some pre-fermented mixes and stuff. And when we were at Folk and we first opened that restaurant, that was something that I did on a nightly basis. And it really got me, like, that's like, that kind of sparked, and I knew the secret lies in your starter. If your starter is healthy, you feed it at the same time every day, the same increments, the same time every night, however many times you want to feed it, as long as you're feeding it the same stuff and it's super consistent, you're going to have a really healthy product, right? And that can take you anywhere when it comes to the bread baking. And like, I used to have so much anxiety about whether or not my bread was going to rise. But because of the system we have built into St. Vito now, because of the experiences that I've had in the past with natural leaven products, just seeing it, like, not even being the baker at restaurants like that, just like being around, it's like osmosis, right? Like, you just naturally learn it and remember it. If you start as a baker with us, or you're going to start making dough with us, it's like, this job will give you some anxiety. I call it dough-xiety, because you're always, at least I have it, because I'm always thinking about, like,
same, you know, I have it too.
You're right. And like, whether or not it's going to do right or whatnot. But like, honestly, like, I tell people all the time, like, you just have to trust it. It's out of your hands, really. If you did all of the things leading up to making it the correct way, it's out of your hands. And you're going to like, it's like letting nature take its place. It just happens.
I'm so glad you said that, because that was one of my questions. Like, I gave up on sourdough for a number of months, and I'm actually picking it back up again. And it was just, I wasn't feeding it right. I was like going in and out of my fridge. I was feeding it whenever. I wasn't like giving it time to digest all of its food. I was mixing it cold. I was overfeeding it. And I think that it just wasn't rising. And so one of my questions for you is like, how do you get the rise that you get? And consistency.
Yeah, consistency on your feeds. I mean, that's it. And then the other part is like, you know, it's never going to be the same. Every single batch is different. There is no, like, from my experience, and like I said, I'm not a professional baker, I guess. I'm not like a trained baker. Like, I just know what I know. I know the science behind it and why it works. I've watched other people do it. I've baked this dough enough now where I like have a great feel for it. But like, 2 or 3 weeks ago, we had a massive snowstorm here, and there's like 10 inches of snow, and then like three inches of ice for like 6 days, 0 degrees at night. All right, I'm going to open up that night, right? It's 13 degrees is the high. I'm not using any bread proofers in this restaurant. We proof everything naturally, room temp, ambient. It's not going to proof the same. Like, you've just got to know walking into that day that what takes you 2 hours normally is going to take you 4. So, like, you're just going to have to figure that part out. Like, the air's colder and it's just not going to move. And then the same, you know, the same time in the summertime, like, it's going to take you half the amount of time in the summer when it's super hot than it does in the winter. So, like, that's kind of a battle every day coming in here. We bake about 40 to 50 loaves off a day to keep up with our services. And every single day it's different.
Great reminder. Thank you. And I guess with that, I'm not even going to ask you about the cold ferment, because I feel like you might even skip that on some days, or no?
Cold ferment?
Yeah, like, do you put it in the fridge?
So best product is a 2-day, but if we have to, it's, you know, we'll go next day. But we never go same day, ever. It's a totally different product if it's same day. But we'll definitely go next day. Still a great product. If we can get it to that 2-day, it's fluffy and light and still has great sourness. Now, if it goes 3, I find that it's a little too sour for what we want.
And I sort of want to know now, when you par bake these doughs, are you still using the 10x14 Lloyd Detroit pan? And what is the dough weight?
So I'm okay with anything in between 950 and 1.1 kilos. It's kind of where we're at. So it's a pretty hefty loaf.
It's a hefty loaf, but a lot of it's water too, to be fair. And I think we'll get into the topping shortly. One thing that I noticed is you top it, like you top to the edges, right? Which is cool, because like, you don't need a lot of crust because it's really underneath, right?
That's right. And we stuff it with cheese. So every slice.
Fontina studded. What does that even mean? What is that? Like, you're.
We cube up an incredible amount of Fontina cheese weekly here. Goes into the pizza doughs while it's raw.
You're pressing it down.
Pressing it down. It gets 12 total chunks. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. That also provides us kind of a map for cutting it into slices, because we don't use the mezzaluna. We use bread knives. We cut everything by hand.
Oh, because you're trying to keep the integrity? Do you find that? Oh, okay.
So you cut right in the middle. So when you get a whole loaf, you know, you cut right in the middle of where 3 pieces of cheese lie. And then you cut down the center so that every slice should have a piece of Fontina on the edge that just goops out whenever you put it on a plate.
Oh my goodness, I love that. Fontina stuffed crust? Yo! I'm sure Michael has a reason to choose Fontina. Unfortunately, Baccio cheese does not have Fontina. maybe one day. But what they do have is delicious pizza cheese that has a kiss of buffalo milk. So if you're trying to make a unique pizza like Michael is, consider going with Baccio. Did I mention they're my favorite cheese for Detroit-style pizza? They make an amazing white cheddar mozzarella blend that just tastes so buttery. So good. My favorite for sure. If you're interested in learning more about Baccio cheese, I'd greatly appreciate it if you reached out to them and checked them out. Use the link in the show notes or just DM me and I'll connect you with them.
And then we like have those like, you know, and then it's just like those little details and stuff. It's like every time we present a slice to a customer, like that edge is supposed to kind of point towards them. So that's the first thing they see, right? Is like that big chunk and the cheese melting out. It's like, oh, you know, obviously we get really busy and it's really hard to like concentrate on doing that. But like if it's there, we are always very cognizant of like put it where, you know, eat with your eyes first. So.
Wow. Genius. Bake time of the par bake and temperature.
Yeah. Something we play around with a lot, honestly. Number one, it's like, I have a triple deck electric pizza oven.
Pizza Master. Shout them out.
And there's a few inconsistencies in there. And that's any oven. That's not picking on Pizza Master. That's every single oven you ever buy and at any time, right?
Heard.
It's so odd. Like when we first got the oven, my middle deck was just like ripping. But we use the middle deck the most to pick up all of our slices and our whole pies during service. And we pick that up at 500 degrees. We keep the top deck higher so that we can do like, you know, pepperoni and get those cups blasted real quick, or a cheese pizza and get it done, you know, get it real quick. Or we pick up stuff on the line. Like we have like a jumbo shell that we stuff with like crab dip pretty much. We put into like a pink sauce. We like throw it in a little saucier pan, put a top on it, pop it in that 600 top deck. It takes like 7 minutes, pull it out. It's perfect. Done. And then our bottom one, we'll keep it like 350, 400. We see the restaurant getting really, really busy. We see online ordering starting to come in. We'll fill that sucker up with like 10 pies, right? Brings them up slowly and keep getting like they can stay at that nice, consistent temp. And then all we got to do is pull from the bottom to the middle. Boom. We have them instantly. And then, you know, each pizza has six slices in it. And that gives us the opportunity to like just get it out fast, right? Like that's kind of our whole goal, is like get that out fast. But when we're baking from raw, you know, every time you open that door, it loses temp, even though it has that like extra coil right there to try and keep the heat in. And every time you put something on the floor, it's going to drop down. So like we started off baking at like 720. Because we knew that it was going to drop. I like to bake at a high temperature to get those rises, but at the same time, it's not always going to be me baking. So I have to streamline that consistency, go back to that. I feel like that's the word of our conversation.
Hell yeah, it is. If you were to do like a high temp bake and a low temp bake, so you have 500.
Well, my 500 is to pick up the par bakes. When we bake from raw to par bake for that day, I'm baking at about 625 because I know it's going to drop when we fill it up to about 560 is what I've seen. And I never want to bake under 540. That's my rule. Don't ever throw anything in there under 540. If it's over 540, though, you can bake. But if it's under, give it time to reset and get that temp back up. But we set it at a higher temperature, knowing that it's gonna drop. When we first opened, I had like this baker. He's a great dude. He's no longer with us, and like one of the problems that we kept having was like, he'd throw 10 pizzas on the deck, all just straight on the floor, right in the pans. Well, when you do that, you're just dropping the temperature all the way down. And then also, there's so much water in that dough. It's just like releasing out. You're not getting – nothing's getting good color. Nothing's getting a good rise. Everything's kind of a mess. You end up having to like throw away pizza. So we bake on sheet trays. And I can fit three sheet trays in each deck, and each sheet tray has two pizzas on it. And so I only bake six at a time per deck.
Wait, so you're putting the 10 by 14 pan on a sheet tray?
Yes. And then that gives me the ability to grab the whole sheet tray, put it in the oven.
And it's just limiting you from putting everything all at once.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to take the time to make this dough, right, that's not that easy to make. You're taking the time out of your day to feed starter multiple times, to make a levain, to get the right flours, to get all these things right. And then if you're going to bake and you're just throwing it in there haphazardly and being like, ah, whatever. It's like, no, what's the fastest, most consistent, like smartest way that I can cook and I can create this product in a streamlined manner? I'm buying some cheap sheet trays and I'm going to bake on them, because now I know that my floor needs to be a little bit hotter because I'm baking on a sheet tray. There's an extra piece of metal in between the dough now, and I need that to be hot for oven spring. But I'm gonna keep that a little bit higher, but it enables me to be able to move quicker. So I can grab the whole tray, turn it when they need to be flipped, put it back in, and then when they're done, I'm just pulling them out, putting them on a rack. Boom, boom, boom. And then I'm pulling from underneath, right? And then it's going straight in. So like there's just this system of a speed rack full of raw dough. You start from the top. You put, you know, 18 in the oven, and then you have the others on the bottom. They come out, go back where they were. Then you start pulling from the bottom, and you can just go, and you can get these bakes done pretty quickly. Yeah, I just felt like that was the smartest thing for us to do.
Dude,
and it's easy to teach people to do that.
Well, since Michael got to plug his oven, I want to plug mine. Uni Pizza Ovens is changing the game with the Uni Volt. Dual temperature cooking, electric pizza oven. I mean, come on. The best pizzerias are using electric ovens out there, and now you can use it at home or on the go. These portable ovens allow you to practice your bakes when you're getting ready to start your pizzeria, or even if you already have one and you just want to get your practice in small batches, whatever the case may be. Check out Uni Pizza Ovens for all of your pizza needs. And please use the link in the show notes if you're ever considering getting anything from Uni. I'd greatly appreciate it. That is so smart. That is so freaking smart. And I Adam El Paya from Pizza Paya, my guy, if you're listening to this, I love the viral content that you have of just like loading up 16 Detroit pans one at a time and like taking them out. It looks cool on Instagram, but dude, check this out. Like put everything on a sheet tray, one go.
Yeah.
That's smart.
Yeah. I've seen those videos too, of them like pulling them all out. And I've always thought to myself, I'm like, what are they doing? Because I mean, if you look, like my arms are burnt up enough just from reaching in and getting it. It's like, I can't imagine standing there and having to pull. Also, like, you know, you only have like the short time limit before, because that oven's freaking hot, right? And like, if it goes 2-3 minutes over, like you're starting to get a little brown on top. And you're starting to burn them. It's like, and using like the pizza peel, like the tool, try and dig them out. And it's a metal pan. It's heavy. It's not like it's
and it's deep.
Yeah, it's deep. It's like, no, I mean, I'm not fighting that. I'll just pull it out like a shelf.
So you're looking for like just the dough to turn slightly colored, no dark marks on there?
Yeah, it's dark because it's dark. Of the hydration. We have to fully cook our pizza or it falls.
Are you sticking a probe in there?
Oh, yeah.
So that you know what?
We
what,
temp
what is
every
your...
single one of them.
Okay, like 200, 205. Okay. I just learned that the other day from the guys over here at Acre Pizza. I was like, what are you doing? And they're like, oh yeah, there's a doneness level. And I was like, what? I've been under baking dough probably, but 205.
Okay. 205 is my mark. Some people say 195. Some people say 200, you know, but for us, 205 is where it's at. And I'll pull them out to probe it. Done. Goes in. I can't, you know, but the thing is like we talked about, everything, every single one of them is different. That's why we have to temp every single one of them, because, you know, there's a variable of gas in each one. Like they're totally different. They're the same dough in the same pan, in the same oven, cooked at the same temperature, but there's a difference. And if we don't cook it to 205, it'll look super great. And then within 10 minutes, it's like just completely falls.
Crazy. That's so crazy. Amazing stuff that I'm hearing. Freaking light bulbs going left and right. And I'm pretty sure the audience is going to love this. Do you want to talk about your menu, your year in the brick and mortar? What do you want to do with the rest of our time here?
You know what? I think a good avenue is to talk about what it's like to go from, you know, a pop-up to a brick and mortar. And then also kind of like something that I always love to talk to people about is like the business side of stuff. You know, what I feel like my role is now in the community, you know, and I think that's important. You know, we started all this out of my house. People would order pizza off of Instagram. Local tattoo artist that's quite famous named Chad Copinger, Adventure Tattoo here in town. He used to be in Brooklyn or New York, Manhattan, I think, Lower East Side. He drew our logo, which is two lions. And it's a lion because of he's the official animal of the Kingdom of Sicily. And my grandparents were Sicilian. My mom's side of the family is Sicilian. So it's something I always wanted to do was like maybe have like a Sicilian style restaurant. So that's what we kind of try to put forward here is like, you know, Sicilian style sfincioni pizza. And then all of our small plates need to be some sort of Sicilian derived idea. Nashville is it's a hot city. Everybody's moving here from everywhere. There's all kinds of huge restaurant groups from New York and Atlanta and Chicago moving here. And, you know, that kind of dumps on the local crowd a bit. Rent prices and everything are really high. And it's kind of absurd, actually, how high some stuff is. Somebody contacted me last week and they were like, $86 a square foot, you know, down the road. You know, your $30,000 rents, it's like for 2,000 square foot space. It's like, you know, like do you want business to be profitable here or not? You know, like, so for me, I take a lot of pride in trying to be kind of that like local leader, you know, that built a business from their home and from the ground up, but also offer up my space to others that also have concepts on days that maybe we are closed and they can do their thing here and they can get a chance to hand over their business plan to potential business partners and investors or lenders. And they can, you know, build on their idea because, you know, it's like, I don't know. It's like there are doers and then there are people who don't. And you just need that extra nudge or you need that confidence boost. You need that ability to showcase what you have. And I think, you know, for so many different cooks in the industry, it's hard to get that chance, right? Like, it's a grind all the time in the kitchen, and it takes years and years and years of being a line cook and then being a sous chef and then being a CDC, and then it's like, you know, over those years, and that's normal for any industry, right? But like, you know, we have a pop up every Monday, Tuesday for the next few weeks called Foxden Izakaya, and one of the guy that runs it has been doing it in town for a few years now. He's obsessed with like handmade Japanese noodles and like really proper technique, broths and ramens and stuff. And he works for me. He was talking about doing like residency and doing some other stuff in another spot in town. And he's like highly valuable, you know, to our team. And it's like, well, why don't you just do it here? You know, like I would rather you be able to work in this space and feel like you are home here with us and do your concept. And I like give you the opportunity and the chance to showcase what you have going on. We've hosted him multiple times and he's going to be doing it every Monday and Tuesday for the next like 6-7 weeks. And then we've done other pop-ups here, even though we've only been open for like 10 months, we've done a couple other ones here in town. That, and to me, is really important is being like a local chef. You know, I have two kids, I own a house here. Like I am part of this community. And I have this space that we built very intimately, 13 seats that sit at a bar that look directly into our kitchen, and all the cooks and stuff serve you and pour your water and give you, explain dishes and have conversations with you. Well, I built it that way because you literally used to walk into my house and buy a pizza from me. That's how this started. And I feel like it's very important to have an intimacy between business and customer, chef and customer. And, you know, we don't want to be too stuffy here. We don't want to wear white gloves and have tablecloths, right? We want it to look nice. We want you to feel good. We want you to have fun in here, but it's going to be loose. It's going to be a little loud. You know, if you're acting up, we're going to ask you to leave. If you're having a great time, we want you to stay. Like, you know, and I don't know. I think for us and what we do and our motive of creating a good culture to work in, everyone's nice to each other. We want that to bleed through to our customer base. And I think it really does. I think people really enjoy sitting at the bar and having a conversation with all the cooks and all the servers and everybody. You know, if you have something that you want to showcase and it's good, you can come to us. We can have a conversation. I think too many people are uneducated on the side of business when it comes to like how to find an investor, how to work a business plan, how to raise money. And I was, honestly, and it took me a long time to figure it out. I probably went through like 7 or 8 different investor groups before I landed on my business partners. And that's because each time that it didn't work out, it was either on my end or it was on their end, right? Hey, we don't want to do this deal anymore. I learned something. Sometimes sometimes you have to fail a couple times, right? And like, there's not enough people out there willing to share how to build something from the ground up. And I really hope that St. Vito can be that place in Nashville. I really want to do that for people.
I think it's great how you are so community driven and you're sort of, you know, paying it back or paying it forward, however you look at it, because you were hosted for your pop-up and now you're sort of, you know, fostering that environment also. In terms of the, you know, 7 or 8 investors that didn't pan out, like, you have a piece of advice that you live by. It's always darkest before dawn.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure going through that many number of investors, it's just like, damn it, again, it didn't work out. And I would love for this to be a learning opportunity. Coincidentally enough, someone just DM'd me on Instagram today and was like, hey, do you have an episode on investors? And I had to, you know, look through the archives about and very like old stuff. And so I would love to maybe just get your feedback on like, what were your biggest findings there? What worked? What didn't?
Yeah. I mean, I love talking about this stuff because it's so interesting and it's like something that like everybody's kind of afraid, right? Like every deal is different and every deal is going to be unique to that person and their business and what they want out of it. The biggest piece of advice that I have for people that want to do this, or number one is, like I said earlier, you really got to love it. It's a grind. You open up a restaurant, you're going to be here all the time, all the time. But number two is like, life is a negotiation on every level. And you've got to be willing to give up a few things. You're not always going to get everything that you want. It just doesn't work that way. But you need to be able to go into a negotiation with a business partner or an investor and kind of know where you can draw your line in the sand. You know, I knew out of a deal, right, I wanted to be the majority, but I didn't have to be a 70% majority. I didn't have to be an 80, as long as I was 51, or even if it was 50-50, right, we could make a deal together. But, you know, there were going to be those few things like menu, days open, how I compensate my people, size, those things, right? Like, those are kind of some deal breakers for me when I went into it. Did I get everything that I absolutely wanted out of my deal? No. Did I get a good enough deal that I felt like if we were able to build this business and become successful, it would provide for me and my family and it would have the ability to maybe open another concept or more St. Vito's? Yeah. That's what I got out of it, you know, and I figured out quickly what I needed from a deal was an infrastructure side of things, right? Like, I needed someone that had accounting. I needed someone that had, you know, knowledge of the industry on a more streamlined macro level than I had. And that was the business partner that I found. You know, there were many times during the years when we were popping up, we're dead broke, no money, business had no money, owed money. You know, big time chef in town offers you an executive chef job at his new restaurant. Guaranteed, you know, $85,000 a year salary. What do? You know, you turn that guy down, you keep moving forward on this project that's currently broke, you know, and that's, I had to, you know, have those long conversations with my wife and myself. And I thought, if I give up now, I'll never forgive myself, because all I've ever wanted to do was own my own restaurant. And I honestly, I have two kids. I have a little girl that's 4 and I have a little boy that's 1. But at the time, we didn't have the boy, we had just the girl. And I thought to myself, if I have to tell her that I started a business and then I just gave up, it would kind of break my heart. And I think I'd hate myself. So, you know, I just decided kind of when that all was going on, I was like, I'm not going to let anybody stop me on this, right? Like, and that's the same mentality that I have now. It's like, it doesn't matter what happens. No, I won't be stopped. It's not going to. We're going to keep moving forward. We're always going to keep moving forward.
I love what you said, because I was just listening to a podcast yesterday, and this creator that I was listening to, it took him like 5 or 6 years to get to where he's at. And he always believed in himself. And when he was talking to his audience, he was like, I surveyed people on Twitter and asked, do you believe in yourself? And a lot of people responded and said no. And it killed him inside. Because one thing that he did was he always believed in himself, but he always believed that he was going to make it. But he sort of left the how he was going to make it loose, and just knew that it was going to happen as long as he didn't quit. Because you can't lose if you just keep playing until you figure out how.
I very much believe in that. I think that's just kind of who I am, you know, without getting like too deeply personal. I mean, like, you know, along the way, it was just kind of like you fight and claw for everything. Right. And I knew at a very early age that nobody was just going to hand me anything. That's just not how my life was. Other people, maybe. My life was, you were going to have to work for everything that you wanted. I don't know any other way than to just put your nose down and go. Just make it happen. If it has to happen, you make it happen. If it doesn't work out, you learn from it. You retain the information on why you failed, and you don't do it again, right? You try it a different way, but at least you try.
And this is us talking here on a Sunday, when we both have a family and have responsibilities to our kids. It's like, you know, this is the time. I don't know if your kids are in school. I have a newborn, but like, still,
right?
This is family time. Thank
you. Yeah, it is.
Or she's 14 months.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, this is the time we're spending with our family, but this is the time that we have to sit down, record this podcast. I do my edits here because I still have my day job, and I'm still sort of committed to that carrot they're dangling to me, because, you know, it pays for our life. But still, if I have to stay up late, if I have to work on weekends to make this work, I will do it. And I feel like, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I guess your daughter, 14 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. My son is 16, 17 months. Some sort of pretty close in age. And that was the greatest thing, right? Like, we, opened up a restaurant with a newborn, and
congrats.
You know, at the time, a 3-year-old. So it was just like, this past year, I don't even know where it's gone, honestly. Like, it's so much work. It is so much work. I kind of said this the other day. I was talking to some people. I think a customer. I was like rolling out the trash, right? Like taking the trash bin to the road, and the wheel hit the tiniest little hole, just like this tiny little hole. And all the trash flumped over. I was like, this is the hardest part of my life I've ever experienced. And it took the trash like falling for me, like stop and pause and be like, this is so hard. But then, like, you know, going back to what we just talked about of like, you just have to pick the trash up sometimes. You know, I felt like that was good. I don't know, microcosm of kind of like how the past year has gone. Is like, you're good. Oh, the trash falls over. Like, the only thing that you can do, you can't just leave it lying there in the yard. You have to pick it up and go. And that's kind of the way I feel about this past year. But that's opening a restaurant, and that's also just opening up your own business. That's what a small business owner goes through every day. You know, it's just what it is.
I love that. And I love what you said about, like, you have to tell your kids that you kept it going. Like, all of these things. It's like the person you are becoming when you finally have that conversation with them, that one time where it's like, no, you just keep going. Or no, this is what we did to get here. Or whatever life lessons you draw from it. No, I picked up the trash and we kept doing it. And this is why it's a great example for you at this very moment when we're having this conversation. It's like, that's everything.
Yeah. It really is. It's very important to me to be able to relay that message, you know, to both of them when they're older. Not that they'll totally get it, right? But that's okay. I think in time they will.
Well, in time they'll see who their father is and the person they are because of their experiences, and eventually they'll associate it with everything.
I hope
that you
did. I mean, that's the goal. And like that's one of the reasons why I was so adamant about building this restaurant. I was like, I did want my kids to grow up in it. And like, I do make it a solid effort for both of them to come here on a regular basis. Because I feel that it's important for, you know, not only for me to see my kids because I miss my kids, but I think it's important for my staff to see my kids. And I think it's important for them to see me interact with my kids because they see me in here going, you know, I'm a boss, whatever. I'm a business owner. I'm the chef, whatever. But like, there is other aspects of life. There are other things in life. Like, I do think it's important to have that family aspect around so that other people, you know, people get to see a side of, like, look at him interact with his little girl. Look at him interact with his son, like his wife. Like, you know, I think a lot of people don't do that enough. Like, have their family around a little bit so that everybody can kind of get that glimpse of, you know, what you're like not in the kitchen, you know, not hustling. You know, we've been so busy in here that everybody's just dog tired. We've been so busy. It's like you get a little grumpy towards the end of the week. You get a little agitated. But, you know, it's good when your family comes in. You get to get some hugs and stuff. So it just kind of makes everybody a little bit more cheerful, hopefully.
Everyone feels the hugs. And it sort of adds on to that community vibe that you're building. And I think, you know, it's like they see a family, they're like, oh wow, I associate the owner, my boss, the head chef, however you know, are looked at by your staff, and they're like, I respect that, you know, I support that, and I'm buying in on the mission that this is what we're trying to build here, this community thing, this local piece of Nashville. And so I really dig what you're doing there.
We're trying one day at a time, you know?
Michael, you've been very gracious with your time. And I always wrap up this podcast with one question. There's no right or wrong answer. Take it as it is. What's good dough?
What's good dough? Good dough is... like a sense of welcoming community, knowing what you're doing is right, or knowing what you're doing is good for others. You know, I don't cook for myself, you know. I cook for other people because it brings me a sense of joy to make something. I know that I've been given a talent. I know that I've studied under people that have helped sharpen my skills. And I know that if I can create something that makes other people happy. And I think about my mom growing up. And she's a terrific cook. And she would make these massive meals, Christmas and Thanksgiving. And she would never eat. And growing up, I thought that was so odd. Number one, it's because she tasted everything all day, right, for 2 days. But the other side of it is, like, I think I look at it now, and I think she just, like, she was overjoyed the fact that, you know, her kids were here, her brothers were here, whatever, you know, family was surrounding her, and they were enjoying the fruits of her labor. And I think that is kind of what's good, you know. That's, to me, that's what's good. That's good dough to me. That's what that is.
That is so beautiful. Thank you so much for being on the show and sharing. I really, really, really appreciate our time here.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man.
Well, there you have it. My conversation with Michael Hanna of St. Vito Focacciaria. Michael, I was so, so impressed. I'm impressed by your story, your pizza, the way you run your business, everything. I cannot wait to go to Nashville and listen to some country music and eat your pizza at the same damn time. I don't know that people know this, but I am a huge country music fan, and Nashville's calling my name, but it's calling my name even more now because of your pizza. So thank you so much for spending the time with me and blessing us with this information. To you, the listener, I mean, come on! Michael's dropping knowledge bombs left and right, so you gotta do me this one favor. Reach out to him and let him know what's good dough. DM him on Instagram. I'm going to link his contact in the show notes. And remember, any of the show sponsors that we talked about, they're going to be linked in the show notes too. So I really appreciate it. If you need any of them, ovens, cheese, olive oil, reach out to them right there. It'll support the show so much. Remember to share this episode with a friend if you think they'll enjoy it. Anyone in your mind that wants to do high hydration pizza, pan, sourdough, focaccia, pan de cristal, all that good stuff, share it. It would mean the world to me. And then finally, don't forget to sign up for our email list. That way you get notified every week when there's a new episode. I send the show notes directly to you so you can read it and find out if the show is for you. All right? Or this week's episode is for you, because obviously you're listening to this and you're at the very end. And I got to thank you for being here. All right. I appreciate you. I love you. Till next time. Peace.